So number one concern for most people right now is health, not getting the coronavirus. A close number two for many people is financial health. With so many businesses shutting down, the economy runs the risk of going over a cliff, our paychecks going with it. Our next guest works for a different kind of economy. Donnie McClurkin is an affiliated professor of economics at Southern Oregon University and the executive director of the Post Growth Institute. He recently wrote a piece about 10 steps for rebalancing our world in times of crisis. Donnie, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Morning, Jeff.
Just a quick sketch on the Post Growth Institute. Is dedicated to the proposition that you can have a working economy that is not always growing?
That's absolutely right. And in fact, at a time like this, obviously people are hurting. People are focused on the health crisis. We've got an emerging economic crisis that is only going to grow. And it's important to think about those quarter of American adults who just don't have enough to cover an emergency expense of $400. And ask, what did our growth economy leave us with if we're still in that circumstance? If we have record levels of low levels of unemployment before this coronavirus hit, we had strong economic growth, yet we were fragile, we were vulnerable. And so a post-growth economy, which is something that we're going to be able to explore a little more down the track, obviously, when our eyes are not just immediately focused on the urgent needs of dealing with healthcare concerns and economic concerns, a post-growth economy looks at an economy where that debt doesn't have to keep growing, which was a consequence of the economy that we've been in for the last number of decades.
Well, you know, you've kind of given us some of the framework already. I mean, we really went from, hey, some people in China are getting sick to, oh my God, the economy is crashing. But it feels like the blink of an eye. I mean, as you watched this develop, were there some things that cropped into your field of view that you took particular focus upon because of the way you view economics generally?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it is important, for example, to be immediately thinking about how disproportionately people are going to be impacted. We just heard earlier from April Ehrlich about the impact on homeless populations. The same can be said in any kind of crisis like this, that black, indigenous, and people of color, immigrants, anyone who's displaced will, the data shows, suffer disproportionately, whether it's from racism, discrimination, or economic issues in terms of access to healthcare, access to basic services. So that's one piece. And the other that we've looked at is, and this is one thing that it's not a new commentary, but it's one that is certainly cropping up more, and that is levels of debt as we entered this crisis. I mean, the challenging thing for me, Jeff, is to look at what was happening just before this crisis hit. Hospitality and retail were actually already not in the kind of position that the administration federally was talking about. There were already danger signs. We already saw households under a lot of strain. Credit card defaults were at 8.36%, which was actually the highest in 18 months. We saw a lot of automobile debt that had been growing, largely because post-2008, we had this sort of debt binge with interest rates being kept low federally. And as a result, there was this almost mirage of success of an economy that was slowly growing and building up steam. But the reality was that underneath that, the debt has constantly been growing. That's what happens in a capitalist growth system. The money accumulates, the debt constantly grows. And as a result, we're now sitting on debt bubbles that are popping. And there's not much that fiscal policy or monetary policy can do to stave that off, especially in emerging markets.
So it felt like prosperity, but it was actually prosperity based on things we were going to have to give up in the future because of that debt load.
That's right, and that's where it's got a connection with the climate crisis. It's the same thing where we draw down on the future, or we draw down in ways that appear strong, but in reality, I mean, just go back to that stat. A quarter of American adults don't have enough to cover an emergency expense of $400. Why is that after so many decades of prosperity? Despite the 2008 crash, that rebuild that happened, why is that stat still there? The answer is because the system is fundamentally broken, it's unequal, and it's disproportionately unequal.
Donnie McClurkin, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and the executive director of the Post Growth Institute and an affiliate professor of economics at Southern Oregon University. Questions, comments, thoughts about the economy and moving it to something other than what we've been doing thus far as we move out of the crisis. We're not even all the way into it yet, but here we are talking about ways to get out. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Certainly a crisis, certainly a challenge. I mean, in this challenge, do you see opportunity, Donnie? Maybe other than a market correction, maybe a societal correction?
There's absolutely an opportunity here. I think a real precious opportunity. I mean, if you're wealthy, if you're in a position of privilege, your greatest security right now lies in the security of all others. And that is an opportunity for people to consider their position. If you're a landowner, for example, maybe you want to reduce rents for your tenants or small businesses and avoid evictions. If you're someone who's got loans out to others in this community, maybe it's a chance to freeze or cancel those loan bill repayments. If you're a boss and you have employees or you work with teams, how can you support them through this, whether it's childcare support, paid sick leave, flex time, these sorts of things? And then for all of us, there's an opportunity here to do things like moving our money to credit unions, which we know are the safest places to have our money during times of crisis, and ways that we can keep the money moving. Because that's essentially what we need to get us through this period, given we live in the kind of system we do right now. We need to keep money flowing. The more that money contracts and restricts, the less that people are going to be able to keep their services running, and that's going to disproportionately affect certain communities more than others.
So keep your money local. I'm reading right along with the stuff you put in your 10 Steps of Rebalancing Our World in Times of Crisis, published a couple of days ago at Medium.com. That is also, this particular idea of keeping money local resonates frequently with our next caller, Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hiya. Great show. Thank you.
Glad to have you.
I'm wondering if you could perhaps reflect on what you're talking about, taking into account the robots are coming, with artificial intelligence taking lots of jobs. I'm wondering how capitalism, which is failing, I think, how it's going to deal with human beings needing to have all of their needs met. I mean, are we going to be dealing with cash anymore? Bernie Sanders keeps talking about democratic socialism. I'm just wondering if you could perhaps reflect on some of these ideas, such as guaranteed annual income. Also, the reality that the planet can only handle so much of us digging into it. And I'm thinking that the reality is that as we move into the 21st century, we're going to have to get used to having a slightly less fantastic lifestyle as we have right here in North America.
Okay, bunch of thoughts there. Thanks for those, Skeeter.
Skeeter, that's a great question, and it's one that is really worthy of concern right now and consideration. Obviously, it's been a topic of conversation in some of the election to date, in terms of universal basic income. We've just seen the federal administration talk about putting $1,000 checks into people's bank accounts. So,
yeah, whoever would have thought we have Mitt Romney saying the same thing as Andrew Yang?
Right, right. And it all comes back to one thing, which is as we hit these limits to growth, both environmental and otherwise, there is a need to look at how are the benefits being shared of our progress. And that's where, as we move towards a more automated society, the key part of ownership comes into it. There's an opportunity right now, because we're going to probably see a lot of corporate bailouts. We'll probably see nationalizations like the ones that happened in 2008, probably on a larger scale, starting with the airline industries and perhaps some of the retail sector. That's an opportunity, though, for us to think about who shares in the fruits of the profits from those kinds of companies. So as we automate within industries, if the ownership of the companies that are automating, that are putting people out of work, resides with just a few individuals, then we know that the money is going to accumulate with those individuals. But if we can move towards more cooperative forms of ownership, whether it's consumer cooperatives, whether it's mutual insurance companies, whether it's credit unions, whether it's not-for-profit businesses, these sorts of things, then we can actually see the benefits of our technological innovation being shared to all of us, whether that's through a universal basic income or something similar. I mean, we see that in Alaska with the permanent dividend, where Alaskans have been benefiting thousands of dollars per household every year as a result of their oil and gas industry having a major stake in, on a national basis, where every individual is an owner.
Everybody gets checks every year, don't they?
Absolutely.
Alaska, yeah. Donnie McClurkin, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Executive Director of the Post Growth Institute, Affiliated Professor of Economics at Southern Oregon University. We are talking about steady state economies generally, but also his recent publication on Medium.com about 10 steps for rebalancing our world in times of crisis. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about economics now and in the future. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let me come back to step number one, because I don't know if we actually said this, but one of your points is to be outstandingly generous to those disproportionately impacted. And I guess we're still in the process of learning, you know, people like servers who wait on tables, and there aren't supposed to be any tables in Oregon at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, this is an opportunity for us to consider that we're all in this together, and that the reality is the employees in this economy are actually what drive the gains and success for all of us. So, yes, we have those who are willing to take risks in setting up businesses, but the real engine comes from small businesses. It comes from employees who show up day after day. We now have a situation where a lot of employees are needing to work from home, and some places can't maintain that support or keep those jobs going. Thankfully, we're seeing a lot of businesses commit to continue paying their employees even if the business is closing down. I look at the YMCA here in Ashland, and it was great to see that they're going to continue to paying staff, but they're also using their business as a place then for childcare, for frontline healthcare workers and others. And that's what we're called to do right now. We're in this together. How do we find innovative ways to support each other and to ensure that the money keeps flowing?
And on that list as well is increase your charitable giving. So if you've got it and you see that others need it, it's a chance to move things around.
That's a great point, Jeff, because the reality is right now, more than ever, nonprofit organizations are at the front line of delivery of services. And it's very typical in an economic contraction for people to be worrying about their stocks, their cash position, etc. Please, I'm asking your listeners to keep in mind that nonprofits need your support more than ever. Only 32% of Americans have a 401k, so the reality is if you're in that basket, you're part of the minority. Please consider how you can support and keep the money flowing to nonprofit organizations here in the Valley and elsewhere around the world at this crucial time.
So I hear a lot of optimism, or at least a sense of like, hey, we are all in this together, and a sense that we share the experience for good and ill. But do some of the things you are seeing, like people clearing the shelves of toilet paper and hand sanitizer, and then in some cases trying to resell hand sanitizer online, and I don't know, I don't know if you noticed the other day, the frozen food section at one of the grocery stores in Ashland was completely cleared out. No frozen vegetables at all. And I just wonder if that works counter to your thinking about people taking care of each other in a crisis.
That's a great question. I think I have a lot of compassion for people being in states of fear right now. I think that it's a frightening time. It's an uncertain time. It's a natural indication or an inclination, I should say, in this kind of system to want to look after your family, look after yourself. And I think that comes on the back of decades of leadership that's pushed this notion of it, of you're in it by yourself, the notion of the self-made person, the notion of individualism. I think that what we're calling for here and what is emerging in, I would say, at least equal measure is the caring economy that we're seeing. Maybe you've seen the viral kindness campaign that emerged out of the UK where people are sharing notes with neighbors, dropping them into their letterboxes and mailboxes and saying, here's my name, here's my contact details, tick the box of what you need. Do you need me to go pick up groceries? Do you need this kind of help? I think that kind of thing is going to emerge stronger and stronger as we go deeper into this. And let me just state for the record, without wanting to alarm listeners too much, Jeff, I think we're in for a 10-year protracted challenge here. I don't think there's any fast way out of what's emerging. I think there's some feedback loops here that are going to continue to kick in. So we're going to need to evolve in a way that cares for each other because, as I mentioned at the beginning, if you're wealthy Right now, your greatest security is not in whether or not your stocks are going to bounce back up from the bottom. It's whether or not the others in your community are secure. We are really all in this together.
10-year loop in economically, you mean, or not epidemiologically?
No, of course, economically.
Okay.
There, yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. But that's an important point. If we flatten the curve here, which is obviously the goal, that means that we're going to see a protracted healthcare crisis here. Every day that the healthcare crisis continues, the more we have a deeper economic crisis emerge.
Right. And I should point out that when we talk about flattening the curve, we're talking about getting the most severe cases in number down, but it also extends the time window. So that's a really important thing to take in there. I want to get to some of the other points in your 10 steps for rebalancing our world in times of crisis. Volunteer virtually and in person, I think we talked about. Share spare resources is kind of clear. Support aligned programs and legislative proposals. What does that mean?
Well, we've got an opportunity right now in this political milieu to be looking at, when we have government spending, what does that spending go to? We heard earlier in this segment the advocacy that's happening around spending in terms of a request for $1 billion to go towards frontline homelessness services. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing is so important right now. Questions of a job guarantee start to become more and more important. And, of course, the big one, which is universal health care. I mean, more than ever, I think we're going to see spaciousness in that conversation. People who might typically have thought, well, that's a position that is of a certain ideological bent. I think that's going to really crack open now as people say, hold on a second, what actually does it mean to have access to health care if I can't afford insurance? In times of crisis, that kind of thing this opens up an important opportunity for us to really think through a different lens about what it means to have access to services.
It's almost like a twist on the old line about there are no atheists in foxholes. I'm starting to think there are no conservatives in an epidemic because of the fact that we do have people talking about. I mean, Mitt Romney, for example, suggesting universal basic income, pretty much as Andrew Yang envisioned it. And then, of course, as you mentioned just now, the talk about, you know, maybe we should have universal health care because it might have made a change in what's going on right now. A lot to think about. We have many conversations to come. I certainly hope in the future with Donnie McClurkin, who's executive director of the Post Growth Institute. And an affiliate professor of economics at Southern Oregon University. He's recently written 10 Steps for Rebalancing Our World in Times of Crisis. You can find that at medium.com. It was published on March 15th. Donnie, thanks so much for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff.
Good to have you.